welcome to episode 11 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. My name is Rebecca Thompson and I wrote the first investigation into the Post Office Scandal for Computer Weekly in 2009.
And my name is Nick Wallace. I wrote the book called The Great Post Office Scandal.
This week, Nick has interviewed Tim Brentnell, a sub-postmaster from Roach in Pembrokeshire, who got his conviction quashed last year.
Now, Tim went on a secret mission this week at the request of the Post Office Horizon Inquiry.
Was it actually a secret mission?
Well, maybe not quite. Maybe it was more of a sort of clandestine gathering.
Of just a closed meeting, maybe?
Yeah, I suppose technically it was just a closed meeting of select invitees to the inquiry. It was people who'd already given their human impact statements to the inquiry. Some of them were asked back for, I think it was more of just an informal chat, and were asked about how they would like to see the inquiry go forward. So I asked Tim about that because it happened this week. And obviously no journalists were invited, and so he had some interesting things to say about that. But first, with my interview with Tim, we cover the whole of his situation. It's one of the most infuriating things about being a journalist, and certainly a broadcast journalist, is that you can spend an hour, 2 hours talking to someone about their entire story, and you have to leave so much of it on the cutting room floor. Tim and I chatted in detail about how he got himself into a position where he ended up signing off accounts that weren't accurate, how he was persuaded to plead guilty to false accounting, the mental health impacts of that on him, what it was like getting his conviction quashed last year, and then his participation in the inquiry. So I started by asking Tim why he wanted to become a sub-postmaster in the first place.
Well, I was 25, and before I bought the shop and post office along with my parents, I found myself working further and further away from home, from Roach, the village I'd grown up in. At that point, I lived about 10 miles away in the county town, but still work was taking me, you know, hour, then 2 hours drive each way every day. And being a very rural community, unless you're farming or working in the industry, the oil refineries that we have in Milford Haven, then there are no opportunities for any kind of meaningful or rewarding or financially rewarding work in the area. You have to go away to work. And when the village shop and post office came up for sale, it seemed like a golden goose, you know, a perfect opportunity for my parents to sort of pass on some inheritance early was the plan, to give me a foundation of being able to stay and build a future in the area.
And did your parents have a farm? Is that what I remember reading?
We didn't have a farm ourselves, although Dad is from a farming family, and many of his sort of family and cousins in the area are all farm.
Right. And so the shop came up for sale in Roach. What kind of village is Roach like?
A typical sort of West Walian community village. There's at that point, there were two pubs, the shop and post office, fish and chip shop, and about 300 houses. But what you said about Deirdre in Northern Ireland, it's not just when this all happened, it's not just the village that knew me, or even the parish. I mean, everyone's so spread out here. It was almost the entire north of the county of Pembrokeshire that knows everyone's business.
And sub-postmaster is in the same sort of bracket as local vicar, local policeman, local school head teacher. You're a very public, very visible figure.
Yes. I mean, I obviously, growing up in the village, I thought I knew a lot of people in the village, but once we took the shop on, I think I knew everybody in the village. And
this was 2005, wasn't it? And this was 2005 when you took it on. So you had a discrepancy which didn't lead to the termination of your contract, which I think you ended up paying back, which is about £6,000. But that informed your actions, didn't it, when it came to a larger discrepancy? Just take us through that.
Well, I had before that £6,000 one, there'd been several very small ones, which when I was trained, as everyone else was told, well, you know, if you're over, you put it in a pot, and if you're under, you take it back out of the pot. And some months, because I never had weekly balancing, I came straight in as it had gone to the monthly branch trading statements.
I'm always sorry to stop you. I'm always never quite sure how much accumulated knowledge people have when they listen to this podcast. So just tell us about the unders and overs, because you're working with the Horizon accounting system, the IT system, and the advice was you're never going to balance every week, is it? We're never going to balance perfectly every month. And so, you know, what were you told about this?
Exactly. When you produce a cash statement every day at the end of the day, and I was told that, well, never expect that to be zero, because everybody makes some sort of mistake, whether it's a stamp or a £5 payment gone into the wrong stock unit or something like that. They said never worry too much about the day-to-day stuff.
But How many Horizon terminals
did you have? Just the one.
Okay, and how much was the counter turning over a week, would you say?
When I first took it over, it was incredibly busy. Sorry, Nick, for that figure would totally escape me at the moment.
No. Okay, yeah, I appreciate it. It was busy. 17 years ago. But you were taking in money and handing it out in terms of pensions and benefits, were you, rather than taking large deposits? Or was it a sort of a to and fro?
To and fro, and several business. Because we're sort of 10 miles from the county town, businesses were using us for cash deposits. Right. As well as handling benefits and things, and a lot of bill payments and things like that as well.
So tens of thousands a week or thousands a week?
Tens of thousands, yes, for sure, tens of thousands
a
week.
Okay. So tell us about these sort of minor discrepancies and the advice on never balancing to zero.
Well, yeah, I was told, but I said the first balance, I can remember the very first balance I did the first day I had of on-site training, and it was... probably plus or minus a couple of quid. And I sort of looked at the guy and said, oh God, how do we sort this out? And he said, oh, don't worry about that. You know, you'll never balance to zero. I said, but you know, it should balance to zero, because when I put a float in my shop till, at the end of the day, if it doesn't balance to zero, then I want to know what happened to it. Oh no, don't worry about it. No post office ever. But if you balance to zero every day, you'll have auditors here all the time, because the people that balance to zero every day are the people that are fiddling it.
Right. And so under your contract, if you have a surplus, you're entitled to keep it. You don't have to put it back into the system. But the advice was keep it in the safe, because you'll be under next week or a week later.
Yes.
Or
whatever. Yeah. If you're over 1 week, then for sure that will come back at some point.
And so little unders, where you've got a deficit, you're presumably told not to worry too much about, because they would sort themselves out eventually.
Yes. Yeah. If you roll, just roll and wait, and you know, the system will correct itself.
Well, tell us about the £6,000 then.
Well, I had these under and over, and then all of a sudden I had a problem with the accounting of the, I think it came through, I put it down to at the time through the National Lottery. There seemed to be a transaction correction arrived one morning, and I didn't understand it at all, how it had generated, where it had come from. And then I rang the helpline, and they couldn't get to the bottom of it on the helpline. So I had...
Was this a big number? Was this a big figure?
No, it was around the £6,000.
Oh, right. So six grand comes through saying you owe £6,000.
Yeah. You have a transaction correction on your lottery from this date to this date, and you are, you know, owe £6,000. Make it good. And at that point, when I had it, the option to dispute any corrections or misbalances was removed from Horizon, so you had to accept it.
You obviously wanted to know where it had come from.
Yeah, so I rang the helpline and spent a few days backwards and forwards with them, got nowhere. So eventually, I had... the lady that came was officially my manager, but she came and did an audit and said, well, no, this £6,000 is missing. You have to pay it back.
But she couldn't tell you how or why?
No, not at all.
But under the terms of your contract?
Yes, if you want to carry on. Yeah.
Yeah. So you unless you could demonstrate you knew how the loss had happened,
unless I could show there was a problem, which I couldn't, then it was on me.
Okay. So how did you then deal with that £6,000?
It came out of the business account. We wrote a check for it.
Right. How did that inform your behaviour when you then got a bigger discrepancy? What was the atmosphere around that £6,000?
It was, I was in partnership with my mother and father, so they had to agree to pay that $6,000. And it's very hard to say to people, well, it's not my fault or I haven't done something wrong, if you can't explain what the other causes could be.
So, and were your mum and dad silent partners when it came to the post office side of the business? Did they not do any work on the terminal at all? They didn't know Horizon,
right? Not at all.
So they were asking you, how can you just lose $6,000? Presumably,
yes, yeah. I must have done something wrong. The doubt that then came when the bigger one happened, that those seeds were sown at that point, I think.
So can you remember what year that was? The $6,000.
It was roughly 2008.
Okay, this is in the not remotely reliable phase of Horizon. In fact, I think you never went to Horizon Online, did you?
No.
Okay, so this is the old legacy Horizon, which was, as we now know, prone to throwing out random figures and random mistakes for no apparent reason, if that's what the cause of that discrepancy was. So what was the bigger discrepancy and when did that happen?
That came in either the very end of it was within 6 months of that first one happening. So it was the end of 2008, beginning of 2009.
Okay.
And again, transaction corrections arrived one morning, two of them, but totaling £22,500.
Jesus. Were they on the lottery as well?
They were on the ATM machine.
What happened next?
Well, I fell through my arse, basically, having learnt last the time before that I would be held responsible for it. The only option I had on the screen is to accept it, to be able to open. You turn your terminal on at quarter to nine in the morning, and there's people queuing up at 10 to 9 for the post office, and it comes up and says, there's £22,500 discrepancy. Would you like to pay this now or settle centrally, pay it out of your wages each month?
So this is something that I've spoken to so many sub-postmasters about, and a lot of editors sometimes want to know, as in journalistic editors, want to know what options were available to people when they had this discrepancy. And we know, and I think it's been sort of widely reported, that the post office removed the ability to put it into suspense.
Yeah.
And I think this was described in court as simply to make things tidier for the post office. The rumours were that obviously so much was being put into suspense because so many errors were happening that the post office was unable to cope with the amount of money that was going into that account. So they just closed down that option. So you then had either the option to pay it immediately, the option to settle centrally, I think it was called.
Yes.
Which meant I will give you a check, with it when I receive a demand for it. But other people have always said to me, and I think I've asked that question, well, why don't you just close? Or why don't you just refuse to accept it and roll it over into the next trading period? And what position were you in that would stop you from doing that?
Though, as far as I knew at the time, those were the only two options that I had, was to accept it then and make good cash, or to settle centrally.
Was the fact that if you pulled down the shutters on the post office and said, look, we're not going anywhere, we're not doing any more trading until this is sorted out, was that something that crossed your mind, or was it just you just never even considered it to be an option?
Didn't consider it to be an option. I've got to keep open, because it was such the local community, it relied on it so much, but the shop also relied on it so much for football.
Yeah. All right, let's turn it the other way around. What would be the implications if you did think of that and pull the shutters down?
Again, that it never crossed my mind at the time to sort of refuse to open or to close it, because I assumed that whatever option I chose, there was this £22,500 that would need paying immediately, and not thinking that we could afford to pay that out in one go like that.
The other option was only something that I discovered after talking to a lady called Helen Baker, who ran her own sub-post office and tried to help a number of sub-postmasters who were having difficulty. And she said the reason that I'd never heard of it was because many sub-postmasters weren't aware of it, which was that you could still keep rolling over a disputed discrepancy without pressing settle centrally or settle to cash. Did you know that was an option? Did you think that was possible, or is she right? Is that feasible?
I don't know. It wasn't an option that I was aware of.
Yeah.
When I was in that position.
Yeah, apparently she told me that apparently if you do roll over a discrepancy, it sends warning signs saying, you know, you have to resolve this, but it still does let you keep trading. But the post office never told anyone this, and the computer itself flashes up warning signs. Okay, but that you were never informed about anything like that. So as far as you were concerned, you had two options, which was pay it or pay it later.
Yeah.
Or accept responsibility for the debt or pay it later. So what did you do?
I accepted it because I thought that was the only way to be able to sort of continue trading, and thought, well,
so that £22,000 is now your legal responsibility. You've accepted that as a debt to you, or a debt that you owe, right?
Yeah.
Then what?
Traded for the day. Went back and sort of tried to look through everything for hours that night, and gave up in the end because none of my branch trading statements or receipts or transactions that I could find made any sense, or I could add up or make sense of this £22,500, where it had come from or what had happened.
Did you call the helpline?
Not on the big one, no, because I assumed that the last time I called the helpline, I had, you know, an audit within the week.
So how were you feeling at that point?
Terrified. because after paying, you know, agreeing to help pay the £6,000 discrepancy, you know, I'd have been quizzed by my mum and dad saying, well, you know, where's this money gone? What have you spent? Have you, you know, repeatedly asked, what have I taken it? What have I spent it on? Is someone blackmailing me for the money? What trouble have I got myself into? All these kinds of things, to which you just sort of deny and say, no, this hasn't happened. But when you can't present like a feasible reason to where this money has gone, you know, I can appreciate that it's very hard to believe someone.
Did you receive a demand for the money? Well, after you hit settle centrally?
No, I didn't settle centrally. I settled to cash.
Oh, so you told the system that you'd put £22,500 into it?
Yeah. Yeah, and then inflated a stock unit to with the intention. I mean, I sold lots of things that I owned. I put as much money that I could find into it each day, each week, whatever, you know, as time went by. Which is why when I was audited, because they obviously realised that something was going on, that I'd paid back. I got the disputed amount down to about 15,000, 15,500 within a few months.
Because so you put £7,500 of your own money into this hole in your accounts, with the intention of continuing to do that for the remaining £15,000. So you just kept this on the quiet so that eventually the books would balance and.
The books would balance, but then my intention, as I said to the investigators at the time, and in court, and ever since, was that once I'd got that discrepancy back to zero, was to go back to the auditors and say, look, there's been this problem, and I have now I've paid the money back, but now you need to come and audit it properly. To see, is this a massive cock up on my part, or do you now owe me the money?
So the thinking was, I've settled to cash slowly, but I've done it eventually. Now I want you to tell me where this hole in my accounts came from. Because you'd settled and because you'd balanced the books, you wouldn't be under threat of losing your job or losing. Any further sanction, put it like that.
That's a much more concise version of what I
was trying to say. No, listen, it's really interesting. I think one of the joys of this podcast is that when you are a reporter and you talk to people about what happened to them, you have to try and sort of go for concision and trying to boil it down. But actually being able to talk about it at length and try and explain it to people who maybe have questions about this process, this is, I think, quite a good forum in which to do this. So what happened then when you'd managed to pay off £7,000 but hadn't paid it fully?
I was audited.
Right. It completely out of the blue, was this?
To me, yeah. Because everything had carried on for since those transaction corrections came through for about 4 or 5 months.
Without any further transaction corrections?
Yeah, without any further things.
Okay. So what do you think triggered it? Do you think they just looked and thought?
I assume some system or someone somewhere noticed like the fluctuation in the cash or between the stock units, and it was picked up on that. Hang on, this isn't, you know, something's going on.
Right. It could have been a manual, or it could have been an auto red flag that had gone up somewhere, and
yeah,
they decided they wanted to have another look because you had a history, because you'd already had a $6,000 transaction correction. Okay.
Yeah.
Even though it was in a different part of the business, on lottery rather than ATMs. Okay. Yeah. Explain what it was like when the auditors came that second time.
I've heard more than one other person say this. When they came the second time, as soon as they walked in, I thought, brilliant, this is going to get sorted out, because I've had enough of trying to sort of do the mental arithmetic around what I'm doing and work out each time when I put money back in how much, what the total is, or, you know, how much. And they came in and they ran their, we've come to do an audit, and they print off your trading statement. And at that point, I said to the auditor that you're going to find this hole. There's a hole here. This is what I've been doing. I'm so glad you're here, because we can get to the bottom of this and find out. And as soon as I told them that, the atmosphere changed immediately. And they said, right, well, you'll have to stay in the office now while we go through everything. Within about 15 or 20 minutes, one of the, because it was a man and a lady had come, came with their mobile. And I said, oh, someone needs to speak to you on the phone. And they said, oh, this is your contract manager. You're suspended immediately, without pay, and would be in touch. And that was it. I didn't have anything more to do with the post office that day.
Did they lock you out?
They told me to stay in the office because they wanted the investigation team to come and talk to me. But I presume because I'm hundreds of miles into West Wales from and they were based in the south of England somewhere on the south coast, they couldn't come to me that day. So they then told me that I could open or go back into the shop to run the shop, but I was not allowed to go behind the post office counter.
What happened after that then?
They finished their audit and came to me and said, yes, you're right, there's this £16,200 shortfall. So I thought it was 15.5. It turns out later on that they'd miscounted it by £500, so it was 15,000 something, not 16,000 something. You'll have to pay that back. And I said to them, well, this is why I've been doing it bit by bit, because I can't afford to pay it back. I don't want to have to go sort of hand in cap to my parents to empty their life savings to pay for it. This is my responsibility, which is why I've been trying to sort it out. And she said, right, well, what's going to happen is that, you know, the investigators aren't coming today. She said, well, you'll have to go and see your contract manager in Swansea. He'll want to talk through with you. My advice to you is to, whichever meeting comes first, whether it's the contract manager or the investigation team, is have the money for them when you go, because otherwise you'll be charged with theft. Whereas if we have the money back, there's no theft. I said, well, you know, there isn't any theft. I don't understand what's happened. And I want to, you know, is this, I've been told I'm suspended. Is this the end of my job? And she sort of said, well, off the record, you can't go and say you don't know what happens, because then people will think you haven't got any idea what you've been doing. So when you go, as well as going with a check for the money, make sure that you can explain what's been going on.
This then led to what? A meeting with your contracts manager or the investigations team?
Contracts manager first. Within a week, I was in the big Royal Mail building in an industrial estate in Swansea. I went with the contract manager and explained exactly that I didn't have any, and went with the story that the investors are saying, well, what's happened? We think what's happened is that the lottery till of the post office is on the side of the shop business, and the ATM is open much longer than the post office, because especially during the summer, the post office was open 9 to 5, and the ATM and the lottery and the shop are open till 8 or 10 o'clock at night during the summer season. So like, well, what's happening is I'm counting at the post office at 5 o'clock, and there's got to be some sort of mix-up then when other things are getting closed down or moved around, leading to these discrepancies that have built up to these big transaction corrections. And the contract manager, because he was first, he sort of underwrite, and I was sort of coming to it from the point of, well, you know, give me the proper training or the proper, explain to me what's happened so I can go back. You know, I want to go back. I want to keep the post office. It's a huge part of our business and the community. He was very, at that point, he was very friendly, and there was no accusations of theft or wrongdoing, just sort of, oh yeah, you sounds like you've got yourself into a muddle. Thank you very much for the money, but I can't make any decision until the investigation team are satisfied that there's no sort of criminal intent.
How did you pull the money together?
Well, I had to go then at that point, because I was on a tight timescale too, back to my parents to say, look, I'm going to get charged with theft. There's been this huge, there's been an audit yet. I think it was the same day I went to see them. So there's been an audit this morning. And if I don't go to this next meeting with the check, I'm going to be charged with theft.
What was their reaction?
Well, they exploded. Again, you know, Dad especially was convinced that, you know, I'd got myself involved with sort of gambling debts or drugs or, you know, something horrific that had meant I'd been taking money from the business to pay people off or pay off debts or something like that. And I left under a cloud, and it was only when Mum rang later and said, look, we've talked about it, and whatever you've done, whenever you're ready to tell us, you'll tell us. But at the moment, you know, all we can do is lend you this money to stop you being charged with theft. And, you know, when you're ready to tell us, then you can tell us the truth.
It's extraordinary the how malign the IT system was, and the way, and we'll come to how you characterize it in the inquiry later, but it's like having a succubus or a cuckoo sitting right in the heart of families, not just businesses sometimes, that sucks away the trust and the strands and the relationships that people have with their parents and with their children and with their brothers and sisters. Because of course, when money gets involved and suspicion in particular starts creeping into a familial relationship, it can completely destroy it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very lucky that we were able to get through that, but lucky on timescale as well. I mean, when this happened to me in 2010, it was rough for quite a while, but we then, Mum, it was, I think, read a piece in one of the retail sort of periodicals, like a little tiny sort of sidebar saying, oh, there's been a problem. There's a group of people that think there's a problem with the post office system, and some people have been to court over it. If you think you might have been affected, give Alan Bates a call.
Right. So this was the Justice for Sub Postmasters Alliance. Yeah. In fact, I think, weirdly enough, Deirdre Connolly mentioned that same little article as well that someone else had seen and showed to her and said, look, you know, there's someone else out there who's saying the same sort of things that you are. But let's say you had a contract manager meeting and then what? And you paid the money back. So you balanced to zero. You were still suspended without pay. Was the post office operational? Did you have someone else running the counter?
Well, yeah, I had a part-time assistant, an elderly-ish lady from up the road. She won't mind me saying that. And when they suspended me, they asked the auditors that were there that day, said to her, once they'd asked her, would she be prepared to open it temporarily? They then asked us, could she use the counter in our shop to keep the service going, which we agreed to, because, you know, it would have been an even bigger storm if suddenly the post office is sort of boarded up and gone. Whereas at that time, I thought, well, you know, I was still in the position where I thought I was going to get my job back in a few weeks.
Yeah.
Once things got sorted out. So, of course, she can open it temporarily and run it, and then the villagers or, you know, the customers will know no different, apart from it's the, you know, the part-time lady is there all the time at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So things looked like they were sort of on an even keel. You owed your parents thousands of pounds.
Yeah.
But the post office was open. You were under suspension, but you thought things were going to get resolved. Where did you go from there?
The next, it was nearly a week, I think, if not just over a week, when I was actually walking through the local town and my mobile phone went. I didn't get it out in time. When I got my phone out, it was a number that I didn't recognise. I thought, oh, there you are, I'll ring them when I get back to the car. Got back to the car and rang this number back to be berated by a very sort of angry-sounding man saying, I'm a post office investigator. You don't miss a phone call from me. When I ring, you answer. And I was like, sorry, what? and it launched into this whole spiel of, you're just lucky where you live, because if I'd have been available that day, I'd have come down and had your floorboards up and found this money that you now say you've paid back. So anyway, I...
That was his attitude from the start?
Yeah, from the first phone call.
What purpose was that serving?
I don't know, because I thought, well, he's thinking, I must have had the money, which is why I've paid it back.
So he's treating you like a thief, essentially?
Yeah, immediately.
Okay. Why did he want to talk to you?
I said, okay, well, I've been told that you may want to speak with me, so how do we do this? He said, well, it'll have to be at your local police station, because I need to... All of our conversations are recorded. And at that point, I said, well, if it's at the police station, does that mean I need a solicitor? Do I need representation? He said, no, this is an internal matter. It's got nothing to do with the police. We just use local police stations because they have the interview rooms and the recording software. So come in and you can explain to me what's happened. So okay. And I did. I went in without a solicitor and was interviewed by him.
Were you read any rights at all? Were you told it was under caution at all?
I presume so. I don't have a memory of it, but I can remember him putting tapes in the recorder.
Did you get one of those tapes?
No, even when I asked for one.
What was his reason for not giving you a tape?
It wasn't available.
All right, so you didn't ask for it in the room?
Didn't think to ask for it in the room, because I was told, no, it's not like a police interview. This is like an internal thing. Of course you don't need any representation for it. Just come and answer our questions and everything will be okay.
And this is where you felt you were being tricked.
Yeah, because we went through everything. And he had all these sort of... What I now know are just like pieces of paper with not just spreadsheets that you could have probably just generated on Excel, wherever they came from. And he said, oh, I can see what's happened here. The ATM payment for that day has gone through the next day because you were closed. So when that's happened and you've rolled over, it thinks there's a discrepancy the month before and blah, blah, blah. I said, yeah, because he sat there and he said, well, there's many more figures incorrect than what those transaction corrections represented. They just never came through before you were audited. He said, but if that's what's been going on, if it's a misbalance between month and month, then that's fine. He said, but there's a reason why these ones. Why have you accepted these ones? Blah, blah, blah. And I sort of explained to him, I said, well, I haven't... You're agreeing with me that I haven't stolen anything, but I've also paid this money back to you. So whose money is it? And he said, well, we have to go through all of these sort of misbalances things now and come up with... an amount of who owes who what. He finished the interview. When we were walking out from the interview, I said, well, what happens now? When am I going to be able to go back to work? He said, well, I think this was in sort of end of November, early December. He said, oh, well, you should
know.
2009. You'll know by, he said, we've got Christmas, which is going to sort of take everyone out of work for 2 weeks. He said, so by January, we should have an answer for you. And the next thing that I heard from them was a summons.
On charges of what?
False accounting.
Which was based on the fact that you pressed settle to cash when you didn't put all the cash in immediately.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. What stopped you from pleading not guilty to false accounting?
I initially I was determined saying, well, I didn't feel, at the time that because I didn't have any, I felt I didn't have any choice, was one string that I had to do that to be able to open and trade. And the second part that I raised at that point was, well, I'd never, to me, my understanding was, you know, false accounting related pertains to like business accounts and published accounts and things for businesses, whereas it was never explained that that's what I was producing in the post office. I thought it was just sort of like, you know, an internal record of what you'd done. So I went to the local solicitor and said, I've been charged with false accounting, and I don't think I have been false accounting. And when they looked at the contract and the thing, said, well, you have, but, you know, maybe you've been forced into a position which might negate that sort of very strict definition of it.
Yeah, this also goes into a complicated argument that I've tried to raise a number of times with solicitors about mens rea, which I believe means sort of criminal intent. You may have technically false accounted, but there was no dishonest intent or criminal intent. You weren't intending to deprive the post office of what you had accepted was now your debt. You were actually in the process of
I paid back £7,000 of it in that time.
I mean, I've had this discussion with a number of solicitors, and they say one of the reasons the post office was so successful in getting criminal convictions was when they leveraged a theft charge against someone. Even the defense solicitors will say, yeah, well, that's technically false accounting. So if you want to get the theft charge dropped, then, you know, it's going to be much harder to prove at trial that you weren't false accounting. But your solicitor was bullish then, was he? Or she?
Yeah, she. Because I never had that. Because I paid the money back immediately then after the audit, I never had that theft charge threatened.
Gotcha. So she was, she thought, okay, I'll take this on.
She thought, oh yeah, we'll take this on, we'll have a look. It went to the local magistrate's court, who referred it immediately, obviously, up to the Crown Court, because it's the post office and the amount of money that was involved. Then, obviously, at Crown Court, you have to have a barrister. So I went to see a chap up in Swansea who was on legal aid for me. But he had what he'd had sort of disclosed to him, again, was just a pile of spreadsheets and things. And he said, well, this doesn't make any sense. I can't argue a case for either side. What you've done from this, it doesn't make any kind of sense. There's no accounts here. There's no numbers that mean anything to me. He said, and I've asked for further disclosure, and they sort of said, no, that's what you're getting.
Was there any indication from anyone at that stage at all that there might be some kind of IT error?
No, not at all.
Was your feeling that someone somewhere along the line has made an error? It might be me, but it wasn't dishonest. Or what was the general thinking at that stage?
Yeah, at that stage, when I was interviewed by the investigator, I said, well, either I've made a mistake, someone else has made a mistake, or the system has made a mistake, which is when they trotted out the classic, well, you're the only person that's had this kind of problem.
Oh, you got that as well?
Yeah.
In 2009?
Yeah.
I mean, they must have known that was a lie.
Well, yes. I mean, I think it was a piece that you did, Nick, we said, I think it was in 2009 or 2010, they prosecuted 50 of us. Now, unless there were 50 separate investigators who only handled one case, they must have repeated that more than once to various people.
And just so that people understand what effect that has on you and your thinking, when you are told you are the only person to raise an issue like this of something going wrong within the system, what does that do to the way you think?
That I must have done, it must have been me. I must have done something wrong, and I've caused this massive problem for myself.
And in those days, I mean, in 2009, you were starting to see the rise of social media, but sub-postmasters didn't tend to be in that much contact with each other, did they?
No, yeah, we had I had social media accounts then, but not I wasn't sort of connecting with any other sub-postmasters. I'd been a couple of years, 2007, I went to a local event at a hotel when a Bank of Ireland credit card or something was rolled out, so they invited all the local sub-postmasters to go to that, and out of probably 20 people that was expected to attend, there was me and one other old lady who went, and so I thought, well, you know, no one's interested in sort of, there's no sort of shared colleagueness.
Around
it, you know, because we all run in separate businesses, and most people didn't have a standalone post office. They were all sort of, you know, sub post offices inside other businesses. So it was a very busy time.
Did you ever consider contacting the National Federation of Sub Postmasters about your situation, particularly after you got charged?
I did. After I got interviewed, I rang them because I wasn't a member beforehand.
Right. So this is post the investigators interview, pre summons.
Yeah. There was a friend who lived at the top of the village, a Yorkshireman who was very sort of pro union and workers' rights. And he sort of said, "Hey, lad, you want to get in touch with your union?" And I said, "Well, I'm not in the union." He said, "It doesn't matter. They'll take you. If you get in trouble at work, the union will help you." And I rang. I don't know who whether I rang them, the main office or a helpline or the main. I rang, found a number for them and rang them, and they sort of said, "Well, you know, if you're suspended, there's nothing we can do."
Right, they wouldn't. Taking your subs.
No.
Or intervening on your behalf.
No, if you're suspended, what was it? If you're suspended, then you're not a sub postmaster, so you can't.
That's extraordinary. That's the second time I've heard that. This issue's come up before. I've heard of another sub-postmaster who contacted the NFSP after they'd been suspended, and they were told, "Well, as you've been suspended, you're no longer a sub-postmaster. You can't join the federation."
Okay,
but this is people in their absolute hour of desperate need, isn't it? This is exactly when you need union representation.
Yeah.
So you were hung out to dry by them. They weren't even going to hung you out to dry. They're just going to wash their hands and pretend you didn't exist.
Yeah.
And you had a barrister who eventually said what to you about the information that he had?
He didn't make any kind of sense to him to form any kind of coherent defence against it. He said, anyway, he said, "It's you know, you're Timothy Brentnell, you're a man on your own, and you're going to stand up in Crown Court in front of a jury against the post office." He said, "Who on earth do you think a jury of 12 people is going to believe? You? Or if the post office are saying you've done this, then they're going to believe. You'll have to go a very, very long way to convince anybody that the post office is incorrect."
And this is where we come to issues with the legal system. Because I take on board what he's saying, but if he's got a client who's saying, "I am not guilty of this offence," then I appreciate he has to give advice because his job is essentially to try and keep people out of prison. But I've heard this posited recently. Is he not in effect asking you to perjure yourself? He's asking you to plead guilty to a crime you don't believe you did.
Yeah, I went to that meeting with him, I was still under the impression that we were going to form some kind of defence or reasoning to why it happened. He said, "Look, basically, you're going to go to if you plead not guilty, you'll be found guilty and you will go to prison. The best advice that I can give to you," I mean, and that's the first time that had been said to me. And you suddenly sit there thinking, "What? Why am I going to prison for something that didn't involve any theft?" And it's just sort of like what you could then think was maybe like a clerical error on your part or a misunderstanding of a process is going to land you in prison.
But I love the way it's kind of like, "Oh, well, you're in the legal system now, mate, and you're screwed."
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it doesn't matter whether you're guilty or not guilty. You're going to go to prison if the post office says you did this in a court of law. Yeah. And I presume he was speaking from experience as a criminal barrister who'd seen the way it works.
Yeah. I presume, yeah, so that put the absolute fear of God into me. I went home, and by the time I'd driven back the hour and a half from Swansea, I'd decided already that the only option was to try and stay out of prison.
What did you get in the end for pleading guilty?
Well, even the judge, when he sentenced me, said, I can remember, he started off saying, "This isn't a case of theft. This isn't a case of any sort of malice. It's probably," I think he phrased it as, "young man's pride not asking for help," because I would only have been sort of 20, 28, 29 when this happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a lesson to anybody to ask for help or to put their hand up when things start going wrong rather than waiting to be found out. Nevertheless, you've stood in front of me today and you've pled guilty to false accounting, so I have to sentence you according to the guidelines set out. And I had a suspended. He did that thing I've heard other people say it as well, and it must be like a judge's sort of trick to put the fear of God into you, because they said, I sentence you to 18 months custodial, and they don't say it will be suspended for what feels like about 5 minutes. They leave you.
Yeah, I've heard about this before. Yeah, you've got 18 months suspended for 2 years. Yeah, and there's always a little pause, isn't there? Yeah. Yes, one wonders whether they're enjoying the theatricality of it, but so the judge again, you know, it would be without precedent for him to throw the case out. Does he even have that power? Or once you pleaded guilty, it's a cut and shut case. He's got to give you, even if it's the bare minimum, he's got to give you something. Yeah. And he's got to give you, more importantly, the fact of a criminal conviction. Did you have any idea what impact on your life a criminal conviction would have?
No, because I wasn't explained to me beforehand that, you know, a conviction under the fraud scale would never drop off your record, because it wasn't until after court I asked the question of, well, how long does this last? And the barrister said, well, forever. It's a fraud conviction. It lasts forever. You think, oh, like, hang on, this is already changing perhaps the way I would have approached pleading guilty. You know, that was something that happened an hour earlier. You think, why didn't people tell me this beforehand?
It's honestly, I can imagine it's like sort of cows lined up for slaughter in an abattoir, isn't it? You're just shuffling towards an inevitable evisceration, and there is nothing anyone is doing to stop it apart from gently nudge you along towards the blades, you know?
It really feels now, sort of looking back with hindsight, that because it was legal aid, the legal side of it really feels like it was sort of a minimum effort to get to that end stage where you were then discharged from the legal system, when nobody wanted to sort of fight or take on anything more than they had to, just to sort of grease the wheels or you know, further the process.
Amazing. What were the effects of a criminal conviction? What actually happened to you, both in terms of your mental health, how you were perceived by those around you, and in terms of financials?
Well, yeah, I lost the income from the post. That job was gone. Yeah, once I pled guilty, then I was terminated. Once I was charged, I was terminated, rather. I then had to complete 200 or 250 hours community service, whichever the maximum hours was, which was, looking back, quite funny, because you go in here, certainly in our local probation office, when I went in, you go in with a group of about 10 people, and the first thing that you do is a health and safety course to be able to operate a strimmer. And the guy running it went around the room and asked everybody, said to people, you know, what's your name and how many hours have you got, so we know how to structure your sort of work plan. And there were loads of guys and a couple of girls there who said, you know, I've got 20 hours, I've got 30 hours, well, I've got 80 hours. And when it came to me, I said, well, I've got 250 hours. You know, they all turned around and looked at me like I was Scarface. I'm like, oh my God, we've never heard anybody with that many hours. What on earth have you done? So I said, well, I didn't actually do anything, to which they all fell about sort of in hysterics that, yeah, well, that's obviously what anyone would say. It's like, well, no, I didn't. But luckily, the probation officer took probably pity on me from it and didn't send me out on the work van. I was placed on a solo placement at the local mental health centre. So I didn't have the sort of the punishment of going out on the work van with an orange vest and being seen, you know, picking up litter or strimming the grass or painting benches. I was on my own, but sort of a pretend volunteer at the local mental health centre.
What about your own mental health?
Well, you sort of retract from everything because, as I mentioned earlier, when everyone sort of questions you, well, why aren't you doing the post office anymore? Well, this happened. Well, what did you do? Well, yeah, I didn't do anything, but you've pled guilty. You know, everybody knows that you've pled guilty to this offence, so you must have done something. And you know, people ask you, and good friends sort of gave the classic, well, you know, tell me now, do you understand, you know, have you done something wrong? Did you take the money or whatever? And you'd say, no. And, you know, a few good friends would say, well, that's all I need to hear because we believe you. But you'd sort of visit the local, go to the local pub for food or a drink, and you could hear sort of background conversation of, oh, there's the guy that's lost his job because he was stealing money. There's the guy that was stealing pensions from the old ladies because people, you know, assume that if you're taking money from a post office, then you're stealing somehow directly out of a pensioner's handbag almost, because it was such sort of a trusted sort of community brand or organisation. It was sort of seen as really horrendous that you would steal from it. And you turn around and say, sorry, you're talking, you know, I was quite sort of bold or brash about it to start with. Say, sorry, you're talking about me. But, oh, no. And you turn around and, yes, like, I told you it was him or something like that. And so eventually you just stop going out or go into public places, because everywhere you go, it follows you about.
You said sleeplessness was a big issue for you. The anxiety of staying up and having your mind spinning around all night.
Because, yeah, I could never understand what had happened, why it had happened. But then you start to sort of question yourself or the actions that you took and imagine, well, what should I have done? How should I have dealt with it? Both to, should I have, you know, back as far as should I have settled? Should I have accepted it that day? Was there anything else I could have done? To, should I have pled guilty? Should I have pled not guilty? Should I have fought it? It just used to run round my mind for hours and hours at night. In the daytime, because I still ran the shop and still did was still doing the community service, the work at the local mine centre, your brain sort of occupied with things that are going on. But as soon as you lie down at night and there's no other sort of stimuli, then all these things would run round for just hours on end.
We don't have much time left, so what I'd like to do is just scoodle forward a little bit through. I think that I've spoken to so many people about the extraordinary sort of High Court litigation. And I'm very taken by the fact that after you got your conviction quashed as a direct result of the High Court litigation and the subsequent quashings of convictions at the Court of Appeal and Southwark Crown Court, you were, I think, in July last year, am I right, in saying that you finally got your conviction quashed?
Yes, July? And that's July. That's when I made contact with you, probably.
Yeah, but one thing you didn't tell me as explicitly as you've put in your witness statement to the statutory inquiry was that after you got your conviction quashed, you slept soundly for 3 days.
Yes, yeah. That we I saw you outside the High Court in London. We travelled back to Pembrokeshire to that day, and I just sort of went to bed and got up to have a drink or do the necessary and went straight back. Just it was amazing. It was like, because there was such a range of emotion when I had the email from Hudgels that it was not going to be opposed.
Hudgels, your solicitors who represented you at court.
Yes. Yeah. I sort of was elated, but then I had all these like anger and not despair, but like great waves of sort of being in tears one minute to sort of elated the next, because it was everything over the last 10 years that came out. But still, until you're in court it's then a fact that it's been your appeal's been accepted, then the weight really sort of fell away.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I can't imagine what that's like, and to have that sort of piece of paper. It's just a piece of paper. It's a formal confirmation of something, but the psychological effects that it has on you. I'd really like to talk to you about your involvement in the statutory inquiry, because so many sub-postmasters have found the human impact hearings quite cathartic. And I'm going to ask you to read out the statement that you made in the oral session that you did, I think, in London. Tell me what your engagement with the inquiry has been like so far, because it's actually you've had a recent session as well, haven't you? But tell me about getting involved first of all. Who advised you to do it, or did you want to do it, and how did it sort of then go from there?
Well, initially I didn't want to do it because I was kind of the mind. Well, I've my conviction's been quashed, and following that, not just yourself, there was a couple of days of sort of media interest, both nationally and locally, and the local paper ran a big piece on it.
Was that nice? Was that nice to see in the local paper, to see that vindication?
Yeah, it was, you know, the opposite of before, because you could think, well, everybody, you know, our local paper has a huge sort of readership because it's the only local paper that covers the three local counties. So I was like, well, everybody is reading this now, knowing that I'm an honest man. You know, I'm not guilty. I'm an honest man.
And you're part of a wider, bigger miscarriage of justice, which is a proper, fully fledged scandal. So tell me, so you didn't want to do the inquiry?
Didn't want to do the inquiry initially. I thought, no, I'm quite happy that I'm, you know, I've been exonerated, and I'll let the inquiry run and see what comes of it. But I didn't particularly want to be directly involved with it. I watched a few sessions of it on the stream that they had up, and it's when the inquiry then was coming to Cardiff in a week or two's time. Previous to that, the then minister, Paul Scully, had questions asked of him or a reaction to things in Parliament about it, and every MP that stood up to ask him referenced it as being the either the Horizon system or the post office IT problem, and that really sort of upset me, because I thought, well, it's a shonky IT system, but that's not what's convict that the IT system didn't convict us. The IT system didn't sort of pressure us or behave badly, and you know, knowing what had come out in the Bates trial and the bits that had sort of seeped out around there, I thought, no, I want to go to the inquiry and tell them my feeling about this, because it's not just an IT problem.
You gave a, I mean, I've read your witness statement, which I'd recommend anyone go and do. It's on the Post Office Horizon Inquiry website, as is the oral session, which, again, you told your story, the impact it had on you. And then at the very end, you read out something which was clipped up. I think you clipped it up yourself or someone else did. And it sounds very trite, this, but it did a bit of business on Twitter. It was, you know, people sort of forwarded it and said, look, this is the issue here. It's not this IT system. Listen to what Tim has to say. So would you mind, Tim, possibly reading out that statement once more for this podcast, so people can get a handle on what... So this is at the end of your oral evidence session, where a barrister queries you about what happened to you and how it made you feel, etc. It has seemed to have become a habit, I think, in this inquiry. I don't think it's a formal part of it, but some sub-postmasters have given their own personal statement directly to Sir Wynne. Would you mind reading out what you said to the chair of the inquiry?
This is what I said. I said, myself as every other sub-postmaster you've heard from and will hear from, had problems that started with Horizon, but the problems did not end with Horizon. Horizon provided the data that showed a shortfall, but it was people who chose to believe that over me and hundreds of other postmasters. It wasn't Horizon that prosecuted us, it was the post office. It wasn't Horizon that encouraged us to pay back money under threat of a theft charge. It was people at the post office. It wasn't Horizon that sacked Second Sight when they found uncomfortable truths in 2013. It was the post office. Horizon didn't try and outspend the 555 in court in an attempt to deny us justice. It was a post office decision. Horizon didn't try and recuse Judge Fraser, the post office did. Horizon did not tell hundreds, if not thousands, of sub-postmasters that we were the only ones having a problem. That was the most egregious of lies, and again, that was the post office. I hope that this inquiry will look very closely, not only at Horizon, but the people behind those decisions too.
It was a very succinct and direct piece of rhetoric, and it had a huge effect, certainly on me, and many of the people who saw you say it. I understand that the inquiry has stayed in touch with you, and they got you up to London just this week, wasn't it?
Yes, just this week, which I assumed once the human impact hearings were over, we would be sort of kept up to date in emails or you know, press releases, but the inquiry invited a number of us to London. Before going, it wasn't very clear what the purpose of it was, but once we got there, it was explained quite well.
You were on a secret secret mission to the inquiry. So what did they explain that they wanted you to do? Because I think you kindly made me aware of it, and there was a bit of chatter about it on social media, but no journalists were invited along to this. It wasn't an open hearing, was it?
Yeah, no, it was a closed hearing to sub-personnel, not just core participants or people that had given evidence. It was open to perhaps family members or people that had only learnt of the problem since the inquiry had started.
Were there of you in the room then?
It was a little bit disappointing because I think there were about 15 guests that had registered an interest in coming to that particular session. But only half of those arrived.
Right. And so about
seven of us.
Was there anyone else from any other parties there, like were the post office there or were Fujitsu there or anything like that? Or was it just you and the inquiry's barristers and Sir Wynne?
Sir Wynne was with us via a video link, and we had the secretariat of the inquiry and an assistant. Barristers, no press.
What do they want to know?
They were mindful of perhaps how public inquiries in the past had sort of had people in for human impact or witness statements and then almost brushed them aside to get on, as they said, with the business of the inquiry. They realised, or Sir Wynne had put this on because he realised initially how important the personal stories of us were, which is why they held the personal impact hearings first. And I think those affected everyone at the inquiry so much that they felt, rather than how maybe inquiries had gone in the past, they should try and do it differently to keep us involved. And it did feel much more than just sort of paying lip service to us. They wanted to know how we felt the public inquiry, the personal impact sessions had gone, and they wanted to know what expectations we had from the inquiry, if that had raised any questions that we wanted answered, if out of their seven or eight sort of fields of inquiry, did we want any more added? What else sort of needed looking at?
That's really interesting. What about, I know one of the things that keeps coming up amongst people that I speak to is accountability. Was that sort of message given loud and clear that accountability has to be central to this?
Yes, I mean, as you'll be aware, there are things that public inquiries can do and things that public inquiries can't do. They can't prosecute people.
Yeah, of course,
They can't sort of hold people. But every one of us...
They can haul them over the coals, though.
Yes. every one of us stressed the feeling that either we really wanted people to be held accountable, or that we were worried that people wouldn't be held accountable.
Sure.
Which are two sides of the same coin. But we were, assured that people would be brought to and asked for evidence should it be required of them, and then all the relevant people afterwards would have the full sort of pass on or handover of this information from the inquiry.
What was the sort of most interesting or unexpected thing that came up or that was either raised by you guys or that the inquiry mentioned?
What surprised me was the emotion shown, not necessarily by us, because as everyone knows, that it's very easy for us to get emotional about what happened to us. But you could see on a personal level how much our stories or our sort of fears or wishes for the future affected the people of the inquiry. And how personally they were taking it.
That's really interesting. In terms of any significant changes to the structure of the way the inquiry is going to be run or what they had in mind that might have been nudged in a slightly different direction by what you were saying to them, I know what tends to happen in these cases is that they listen and they obviously don't make that many decisions, but did they sort of try and steer you in a direction or did you try and steer them in a particular direction?
We didn't want people to shy away from perhaps the big names that everyone's expecting to be called. I raised a point that I'm kind of fearful because it's still referenced a lot of the time as an IT problem. And a lot of the next round of people call for witnesses are from would be from Fujitsu and places like that, that they were perhaps being set up to take a fall.
It was surprising to me that Peter Fraser referred to Fujitsu engineers rather than anyone at the post office to the DPP. And you do just wonder whether or not some executives at a very senior level are going to be saying, well, I was told everything was tickety-boo, so we just had to assume that it was.
Yes, but that's a point I made. If, well, you know, the higher up you go, perhaps the more you rely on, you know, in corporations being told what's happening. But, you know, when you're a director of something, or you're on a board, or you're a chairman, or a CEO, then the buck really should stop with you. And if you have a large group of your employees or former employees that are saying there's a serious problem with this, then those people should do more digging than just relying on maybe the people under them telling them everything's okay, because the problem didn't go away, and none of our stories changed over the last, well, for me, yeah, 12 years, but some people 20 years.
Yeah. Did the Swift review come up at all? Because this is a new document that's been unearthed in August, which is the subject of a forensic examination by Professor Richard Moorhead at the University of Exeter, as to how it came to the conclusions that it did, which are obviously in stark odds with the Sir Peter Fraser's conclusions just 3 years later. That wasn't mentioned, was it?
No, it wasn't mentioned
this week. Okay. The issue of accountability is huge, and I think it splits relatively cleanly between just sort of assuming everything's all right with the IT system, and then realizing that actually there's a lot of things wrong with the IT system, and we may have prosecuted people unfairly, but we're not going to tell anyone about this for 6 years. Did the cover up, did the phases of the sort of this scandal get discussed in any great detail, or was it just like who knew what, or who was taking the decisions to do what?
Well, yeah, so someone else raised the issue of, well, how far are you prepared to go? Because, you know, Is it just a post office decision that they have then lied to other people? But there's the problem of the government representation on the board of the post office, and, you know, civil servant. How many people are you prepared to interview or cross reference to find out who knew what and how far or along the chain it went?
Did they say they are prepared to call civil servants and ministers as much as they are post office and Fujitsu execs?
They said, they assured us that they would call whoever was necessary, and they said although the inquiry is due to run until next year, you know, if something bigger than what we expect, you know, if something develops, then there's no sort of set time. It can run until Sir Wynne is happy that he's got to, you know, the bottom or the answers or the end of the trail.
Do you think they sort of get that people are talking about a potential conspiracy to pervert the course of justice happening within the post office, that serious people who studied this over thousands of hours are drawing that conclusion, that the DPP has already been written to by at least one person saying you need to be looking at a conspiracy to pervert the course of justice here? Do you think that the gravity of this is where the inquiry's head's at?
I feel it is. They didn't say as much explicitly, but from my opinion of the way it's going, I'd agree with that. That's the way that with the path that we're going to be going down.
Yeah, I mean, it does. I mean, you hesitate, especially as a journalist, to give any encouragement or praise to anyone. It's the nature of the job, but it does seem as if Sir Wynne has got a grip of things based on the way he's gone about compensation and the way he released a report this week saying that he's disappointed that there hadn't been any progress on his initial report, which came out in August about compensation. So
they did reference that, Nick, to say that yes, he put out a report on it because it was the quickest way to get his opinion across, but he's still, regarding the issue of compensation, he's quite happy to, if still nothing happens, he will take it back to Parliament and say, you know, regardless of I went for a report the first time, things are seriously still not going the way that they should be.
How interesting. That's really interesting. Tim, thank you so much for your time. It's really great to have a long and rambly conversation and to know that all of it is actually going to get posted up, because yes, so many times you ask the postmasters to tell fairly harrowing stories and then you have to chop it into tiny little bits to make it fit within a 4 or 5 minute piece. So I'm hoping that this will be a useful exercise for you as much as it has been for me, and I'm sure the many listeners who will be fascinated by what you've had to say, both about the process that you went through and how it echoes and chimes with so many other sub-postmasters, and of course these latest developments in the inquiry.
Yeah, it's one of the other gentlemen that was with me on Tuesday in London has, as I have in the past, he did a book talk with you, and said
how, which was this gentleman?
Sammy.
Oh, Sammy Savitt. Yeah. Well, lovely man.
He asked me, how do you find talking about it? You've done a fair bit of media stuff. And I said, isn't it really nice to be able to tell your story without people accusing you or throwing it back at you or being able to argue with you about it? And he said, yeah. He said he was so fearful about putting himself out there. He said, but when he did as I did, when you speak about it sort of nervously in front of a room of 100, 200 people, and all of those people extend their sympathy and their wishes and their horror of what's happened to you, what a different feeling that is to 10 years ago.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that this experience has taught me as a reporter is never underestimate the human impact of this kind of thing on people. Always try and understand what they're having to go through by you know, you can never experience it, you can never have a sniff of what it's like, but you've got to be mindful of it, because the damage goes so much deeper inside than it might do on the surface.
Yes, I mean we had after the quashing of our convictions, and then the solicitors go on to prepare sort of claims for us. Part of that is you have psychological assessments and all that kind of stuff, but they then provided counsellors for us, which for me, the counsellor that I had was brilliant and worked through some issues that I hadn't even sort of flagged as issues myself. But I found the counselling really good, and it's really feels like we've turned a corner.
Great. Well, I'm glad you've had the strength to come through what you've come through. Congratulations on getting your conviction quashed. I hope that your final compensation is what it should be, and that it doesn't take another 3 or 4 years to appear, which is obviously a massive concern at the moment. But yeah. I'm wishing you all the best, Tim, and thanks very much for your time. And give my regards to Steph as well.
I will do. Thank you, Nick.
My thanks to Tim Brentnell, who had his conviction quashed last year.
So, Nick, it is episode 11 of our podcast.
Double figures.
Who would have thought? Yeah. How do you feel it's going so far?
Ooh, is this like a sort of internal review?
Yes,
How do I feel it's going so far? Well, how do you feel it's going so far?
Well, I mean, we were just saying before we started recording, we seem to have kind of a couple of weeks where one of us is very productive and the other one gets a bit despondent and grumpy, and then we change places.
Yeah, you've had a burst of productivity over summer, which I'm desperately grateful to you for, and so I felt recently, right, I've got to step up here, Wallace, and start getting some interviews in the can. But I think that's good. That sort of the way it seems to have worked out, and I don't think this was our initial intention, is that because of our freelance schedule, it's difficult enough booking in a guest and interviewing them. It becomes twice as difficult if both of us are doing the interview, because that means two of us need to be in the same place at the same, well, not necessarily the same place, but we need to be logged on and recording the interview at the same time. And so we've kind of gone into a rhythm where we're chatting either side of an interview that one of us has done.
Yes, which I feel like it's the main thing is that we speak to as many people as possible. And yes, for me, that kind of helps us do that, which is good.
Yeah, and I've just chosen, I mean, it's probably bad journalism, but I've just chosen people who I think are interesting rather than necessarily the most newsworthy. Because, I mean, Deirdre Connolly, who I recorded an interview with, which hopefully I'll get out next week, and Tim as well. You know, I've interviewed these people before, but not in the format of a podcast. Certainly not a long-form, yeah, chatty, rambly podcast. And I mean, Deirdre, for instance, she was quite badly affected by all the recent flurry of activity over compensation, which you can read about on my blog, postofficescandal.uk. And she was very upset, and I just wanted to sort of speak to her just to see how she was, which then became, well, why don't we do a podcast? And I thought it would just be a nice chat. It was a lot deeper than that. And so it was something that I wasn't necessarily expecting to record. But I'm really pleased that we did. It turned into a quite a far reaching interview. So that'll be out next week. And I think the format is working. I mean, goodness knows what it's going to be like when the inquiry is in full swing, and we haven't really got a plan for that yet, have we? Have you got any thoughts you want to share right now?
I mean, about the inquiry,
Well, about how we're going to cover it.
Turn up and hope for the best.
Do you know what? I think that is currently the thing that I've got in my mind. We'll just turn up and something will work itself out. Maybe we ought to, I don't know, go and talk to Whistledown or someone to see if there's anything more structured or formal that can be put in place, because I must admit I'm quite daunted by the amount of information that's going to be coming out soon.
Yes, it's already been quite daunting for me getting back into this story because it is so huge and complicated. So the inquiry restarting, even just those 2 days of compensation hearings that we covered in the summer, they had a lot going on around them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it is, I mean, obviously we're not the only journalists covering this, but I mean, we're the only journalists who so far suggested, I think, that we're going to try and do as much as we can in terms of covering it. But, it's really weird with these inquiries, because I mean, even the Grenfell inquiry, I mean, I know that had the BBC podcast, and obviously it's an incredibly serious story. It's been rumbling along, and TV broadcasters and TV journalists and radio journalists come in and out of it as you'd expect them to. There are very few people who are sitting there on the ground every day, but it's like the High Court case back in 2018, 2019. You just know so much good information is going to come out. But at least this time around, it is going to go out live. It is going to be recorded. It is going to be transcribed, and it is going to be put up on the inquiry website. So, you know, it will be there for the record, but it's nothing like being in the room, as I think we have agreed many times.
No, that's very true. I am looking forward to it, but yeah, it is, the prospect is quite daunting.
But in terms of where we are for episode 11, you're happy? Could be happier, but we're here. Always could be happier, but we're here.
I always feel like I could be doing more. I feel, you know, you kind of get that sense with a podcast where there's sort of no end deadline.
Exactly. There is the work expands to fit the time available sometimes, doesn't it? There's never enough time, especially when you've got to try and pay the mortgage doing something else.
Yes.
Cool. Well, thank you for being here, Rebecca. here's to another 11 episodes. Who knows how far we can take this? Before we go, I've got some notices, if that's all right. There is on Thursday, I should have the date, shouldn't I? I'm such an idiot. Hang on. On Thursday, the 29th of September, I was going to say Thursday next week, but who knows when someone might be listening to this podcast. On Thursday, the 29th of September, I am taking part in a walk around central London, which starts on the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral. It's being led by Ian Fagelson. It's in aid of the Horizon Scandal Fund charity. It will be an opportunity to find out certain things about the history of London. This is what Ian does as a sort of, it's not even a side hustle. He just does it because he enjoys it. All proceeds will go to the Horizon Scandal Fund charity. All you have to do is go to my website. I think I've put the details up there, postofficescandal.uk. And you would be more than welcome to join us at 5 o'clock-ish on Thursday, the 29th of September, for a minimum £1 donation. I've mentioned Horizon Scandal Fund charity. This week we formally launched as a charity only 10 months after launching as a fund. It's taken that long to get charitable status, but we now have charitable status, which means that HMRC will allow us to register for gift aid. So we are now a fully gift aided up charity. So if you are interested in making a donation or a regular donation to the charity, or want to find out more about it, please go to horizonscandalfund.org. We've got a trustees meeting tonight. Can't believe they booked it for Friday night. But yeah, that's how dedicated I am. I'm going to a trustees meeting on a Friday night. If you live anywhere near Walton-on-Thames, which is where I live, I'm doing a talk at Walton Library, which I think is going to cost a grand total of £3 as part of, I think it's Libraries Week starting 3rd of October. I'm going to be at Walton Library at 5 o'clock on the 4th of October, Tuesday the 4th of October, talking about what it's like writing a book. Given that I've written one and a third so far, I'm not sure quite what that qualifies me to stand up in front of people. Well, I think it was because I wrote some of it at Walton Library and I told the librarian there and she was quite excited by this. So so I'm going to be talking to anyone who wants to come along for £3 at Walton Library on Tuesday, the 4th of October. And then the biggie on Sunday, the 9th of October, I'm speaking at the Cuckfield Book Festival in West Sussex. It's a biggie because Richard Osman is also attending the festival. I don't know whether he's there that day or not. But it's his hometown, Cuckfield. So I think he's effectively launching his third, no doubt, multi-million selling crime novel at the Cuckfield Book Festival. And my talk was in the tiny upstairs room, but they moved it to the big room, Rebecca. They've moved my talk to the big room, which I'm very excited by. So if you want to come along and meet Richard Osman, I think, to be honest, he's going to be there on the 8th. I'm going to be there on the 9th in the big room, talking about the great post office scandal and signing books if anyone wants to come along to that. I think that's a little bit more expensive than Walton Library, though. I think it's £12 a pop. But that's down in West Sussex. And anyone listening to this would be more than welcome to come along on Sunday, the 9th of October. I think I'm on at 2 o'clock, but check the website for details. How about you? What have you got coming up in post office world, Rebecca?
I'm hoping next week to interview David Enright, who represents quite a lot of the postmasters, is working very hard ahead of the inquiry to get everything sorted for that. But I'm hoping to speak to him about what he expects from the next phase of the inquiry, what he hopes for. And it'll be good to ask him about the current issues that people are experiencing with compensation.
Yes, also, he's a feisty man, David, as well. He's a good interviewee.
Yeah, I've only interviewed him very quickly at the compensation hearings in the summer.
Met him at the
But he's a great interviewee. He's very verbose.
I'm looking forward to that one. Who else are you going to talk to?
Hopefully, Sangeeta Kalia, who is the daughter of Palmer Takalia, one of the postmasters who, at least in the summer, was not being given any compensation at all by the post office. So,
despite being the first, he was in the first group of six to have his. No, that's not true. That's not true. His conviction was quashed last year, wasn't it? Sorry, forgive me. Alongside Tara Adedeo. But yes, he has not received any compensation. He was also at the, I'm not allowed to call it a clandestine gathering. He was also at the closed meeting earlier this week, which Tim Brentnell went along to. So, yeah, I'd be interested to hear what Sangeeta has to say about
Definitely.
A dad's situation.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to speaking to her.
Cool. Well, there you go. Well, you've got two upcoming. I need to step up again. We're good for each other. We can be in sort of semi-competition with each other about who can be the most productive in getting this podcast out. Thank you very much for listening to episode 11 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal.
This podcast is written, produced, paid for and edited by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace. We are supported with wisdom and expertise by Whistledown Productions.
We're very grateful to you for listening, and as you can hear, we'll be back with more soon. Take care.
Bye.